today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Ann Norton Green, a historian of environment, technology, animals, and Gilded Age America. Ann earned her BA at Brown University, a Master of Education at Lehigh University, and her PhD at the University of Pennsylvania, where she has taught since 2003. She has also served as Associate Director for Undergraduate Studies in the Department of the History and Sociology of Science at Penn since 2005. Ann published her book, Horses at Work, Harnessing Power in Industrial America, through Harvard University Press in 2008. Horses at Work won Ann the Pioneer America Society Fred B. Niffen Award for Best Authored Book in North American Material Culture. Ann has written numerous book reviews and book chapters, delivered many scholarly and public presentations, and received a variety of fellowships and honors, including a research grant at the Hagley Museum and Library in 2005. She is a member of several academic organizations and has been especially active in the Society for the History of Technology and the American Society for Environmental History. Today, Ann will be exploring one of her current projects. She is examining the confluence of human society, the human-built world, and the natural forces of water and environment along the Erie Canal in the late 19th century. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ann Norton Green to the UD.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. Having been told that this is a workshop, I'm going to take that very literally. This is a really new project, and I'm still trying to figure it out. Sometimes when a person, you know, gives a paper, they're presenting a project that they're done with, and their attitude is, I've got my story and I'm sticking to it. And they really don't want to hear quite your critique. I really don't know yet quite what the story is here. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you can tell me about what you're hearing and see if it helps me find a path. So the project is an envirotechnical history of the Erie Canal system. The Erie Canal is usually seen as something technological, but a canal dug across 300 plus miles of New York State is by definition an environmental event as well. We know that the construction of the canal caused macro level transformations of central and western New York State, the upper Midwest, New York, New England, and New York City. So a lot's been written about the canal's impact. However, not very much has been written about the environment of the canal itself, about this new environment that emerged at the interface between the technology of the canal and the natural environment. So I want to try to read nature back into the technological history of the canal, and I think I want to try to read the Erie Canal into the larger environmental history of the 19th century. Few enterprises span so much of American history as the Erie Canal. Because the Erie Canal has been in continuous operation since the 1820s, it provides a site to examine not only environmental change, but also changes in the production of environmental knowledge and changes in environmental ideas and policies, all occurring within the context of a large-scale technological system. So why I'm working on the Erie Canal really stems from my book, Horses at Work, in which I wrote about animal power as a factor in 19th century industrialization. The conventional interpretation was that animal power was inadequate and inefficient, and it held the United States back until they discovered the steam engine. Industrialization depended on mechanization, steam power, and railroads, all of which rendered animal power obsolete. What I discovered was precisely the opposite, that mechanization, steam power, and railroads caused a dramatic increase in the use of animal power, starting in the 1820s and not leveling off until the 1920s. So even as the usage of other forms of power increased, animal power continued to increase as well. In addition to expanding use, I discovered that there was significant and continued technological innovation in the use of horses and other work animals. So in this context, the Erie Canal was central to my argument about the expansion of animal power. The Erie Canal is one of the iconic achievements of the 19th century, one of the iconic technological achievements, and yet relied almost exclusively on animal power for its operation. Canals like the Erie solved the energy problem faced by Americans in the early years of the Republic, when overland transportation is incredibly difficult and it really confines settlement and confines transportation to coasts and rivers. And it had all kinds of political implications and implications for national security. So they have animals, energy, which they can't tap. And so what Americans start doing is rebuilding landscape to create these energy landscapes of roads and canals that allow them to tap into the energy of animal power. And of course, a canal combines the animal muscle with a relatively frictionless, smooth surface. So it cut energy costs dramatically. It cut energy costs by more than 90% over equivalent routes. Okay. You're all nodding, so it sounds to me like you've been taught right about all of this. Okay. So the Erie also shows that steamboats are not the whole story, because there aren't many steamboats on the Erie Canal, even in the late 19th century. So into the 20th century, it's primarily animal powered. So the Erie Canal not only supported my argument about horses directly, but it fit in with my Envirotech approach. So Envirotech emerged about as I was beginning dissertation research, thankfully, because it really rescued me, to try to bridge what had been kind of a gap between technological and environmental historians who saw themselves as working on opposite sides of the nature-culture divide. But more and more of us found ourselves working in both fields. And every time I was working in the history of technology, I was thinking about environment and vice versa. All of the current approaches in technological history provided many ways to include environment in incorporate environment as both a factor and as an actor. And meanwhile, on the environmental history side, you have people beginning to challenge very traditional notions of nature as a separate sphere, and also trying to challenge that nature-culture divide. My work on horses fit into this approach. I'd begun the project actually thinking it was an environmental history of horses, and then found it was a history of technology that paid attention to environmental history. And so I analyzed workhorses as a form of biotechnologies, natural organisms shaped and used for human purposes. Another way of putting this is that horses are envirotechnical artifacts. And the Erie Canal is also an envirotechnical artifact. So this is where this new project is rooted. This project also continues my larger interest in two things. One is the concept of obsolescence. Obsolescence plays an interesting role in how we think about technology, and has a lot of implications for how we understand history and technological change. I'm interested in technological things that are still in use but go unmentioned or unnoticed, or are dismissed as not being useful or still in use, or sometimes dismissed as not even still existing. I've actually had this problem. I've had fights with people about the existence of the Erie Canal. Yeah, I know. It's a little weird. Stemming from this general interest in obsolescence, I may be related to it, I'm interested in how we can continue to challenge the steam power and railroad hegemony that still dominates 19th century history. The notion that steam power and railroads took over and dominated everything vastly simplifies our understanding of the 19th century and of the process of industrialization and of technological change. So I like to ask people when the Erie Canal closed, and of course it's a trick question because the Erie Canal has never closed. It's been in operation fully since 1825, but I get these weird reactions. I tell people the canal is still in operation and they don't believe me. They got mad. So they say, well, but the railroads made the canal obsolete. And I go, no, actually not. And it's the idea of obsolescence and of the railroads is so powerful that I've had fights over dinner tables with old friends who've looked at me and said, no, you're completely wrong. I said, got to be kidding. What is going on with this? You know, the OED defines obsolescence as the process or fact of becoming obsolete, thank you so much, or outdated or falling into disuse. And since the Erie Canal has not fallen into disuse, I pursued outdated, and that got real interesting real fast. Synonyms included old-fashioned, out-of-fashion, frumpish, frumpy, archaic, passé, old, not with it, clunky, redundant, and my favorite synonym of all, horse and buggy. All of which confirmed my hunch that obsolescence was really about fashion and really about the status appeal of newness, progress, and modernity. But I think it's also very, very much about power, about real power, about power over the past, about the ability to try to cut off other possibilities, other interpretations, other stories, all of which might undermine the power structure of the modern world. So anyway, given my work on horses, it seems that as a historian, I've now become, as Rob Kohler said, the patron saint of obsolescent things. So I came back to this topic after I finished the book, and I'd done some other topics, but I kept literally running into the canal. We have a place in the Adirondacks, and you have to cross the Erie Canal, no matter how you get there. And my son went to Syracuse, which is a city literally invented by the canal. And there's a piece of the old canal near Syracuse. And at Parents' Day weekend once, we spent the night at a hotel in Baldwinsville that's on a lock of the Erie Canal. I was ecstatic. It's on that lock of the modern Erie. So I felt like I was getting a message. And then one day I had yet another fight with somebody who told me the railroads had made the canal obsolete. And I came home and said to my husband, that's it. I got to work on the canal. So I'm going to take you on a little tour of the canal to give you a sense of the material environment. And because not everybody knows as much about the canal as I seem to at this point, it's good to kind of see pictures and get a sense of what we're talking about. And there are really three canals, which is what confuses people, I think, when they say that the canal's obsolete, is because it's been rebuilt. It was built and then it's been rebuilt twice. And so what we have is the original canal, which is basically the tour I'm gonna take you on, with a little bit of the enlarged Erie, which was essentially the same, deepened, widened, straightened out in a couple kinks, and expanded with lateral canals. And then in the 20th century, a barge canal, which follows much the same route, but uses rivers and lakes to provide its water. And so it can be used by motorized boats and tugboats and barges. Okay, so it's the early 19th century. Everybody's trying to figure out the best route to the west. They look at every river, hoping that this river will be the one that will be the pathway through the mountains and will funnel all the commerce down into their port city. You know, so like Washington's trying to build locks around, you know, Great Falls of the Potomac, because he sees the Potomac is going to be the big river, and Washington will rival New York City as a port. Only in New York do you get this break where the Mohawk River comes through the mountains here. So you've got the Hudson Valley and then the Mohawk River, and so there's this big break in the mountain chain. So the canal is discussed literally for decades, but it's finally negotiated through the state legislature. It's an entirely state project, which takes it out of the realm of some other technological projects we talk about, like the Army Corps of Engineers stuff. You know, it's completely separate. And they've got, you know, hand tools. And they don't have engineers. They really don't know what they're doing. They've been to England and looked at some canals there, and they just start digging with picks and shovels and plows and scoops and human muscle. And they build a canal that's 363 miles long, 40 feet wide, and 4 feet deep, along a route that has an overall change in elevation of 565 feet, but by the time you add in the ups and downs, it changes 675 feet. This is a lot. It had 83 locks, it had 18 aqueducts, major aqueducts, and more than 350 culverts to carry water underneath the canal. The aqueducts carry the canal over rivers. And so in addition to that, they build towpaths, waste weirs, feeder canals, canal basins, guard locks, reservoirs, dams, side cuts, cross bridges, change bridges, escape hatches. So if the mules fall in, you can get them back out of the canal. You know, so there's just like stuff all over the place. So it was a dug canal, so it didn't use any of the rivers or lakes. They've decided to do it differently. So it really climbs a hill between Albany and Buffalo. And if you look at this first part, you can see This is the part from the Hudson River. There's Schenectady. You can see how steep an incline that is between the Hudson River and Utica. This part being especially steep, there are 27 of the locks were between in that stretch alone. The reason there are 27 locks there is because of this, the Cohoes Falls, which are on the Mohawk River. And this was the major reason why nobody could go up the Mohawk as an easy route. It's the second largest falls after Niagara Falls east of the Mississippi River. And this is a map of what it took to get around it. These are all the locks it took to get around it, and the falls being here. It still takes 5 locks to get around it in the new Erie Canal. So it then crosses the Mohawk on aqueducts. That's the aqueduct at Rexford. There are 2 big aqueducts, and it threads its way up the Mohawk River.
So did they dig out next to the river, or did they put dirt down to set off part of the river?
Both. Okay. Both. In other words, to have a canal, you need a water source. But rivers are tricky because they do things like flood and they go up and down. So you have to figure out how to get the water from the river, but to also protect the canal from the river. It goes through little falls. There you can see one of the structure, the loading structures that developed at various points along the canal. And then it hits, thankfully, the long level west of Utica, around 60 miles with no locks because it was flat. On the other hand, it was also a level that always caused them problems in terms of water supply, but it's a long, flat stretch. And then it goes right through the middle of Syracuse, which was changed from a small village in the 1820s of Salinas to this by the late 19th century. They had to take it across the Montezuma Marches to the west of Syracuse, so they built another long aqueduct. It's the remains of this aqueduct. It went through Rochester. It built another aqueduct across the Genesee River, again, right through the town. This was one of the more famous ones. It would turn up on things like hat boxes and wallpaper in the 19th century. People were really proud of it. And then in the winter, when the canal was closed, they would flood it for ice skating on the surface. So, and there you can see the towpath along the side. So then it goes along the plain, but it has to get up over this escarpment, and they build 5-story locks in Lockport, a place where there was no town, but the construction created a town, and they called it Lockport, because that's what it was. It became one of the internal ports, and you see a boat coming through down from these locks. All of these, I'll get to more of this later, all of these are major problems in water management that you're looking at. As well as how you make sure these things are filled and have enough water. Coming out of Lockport, there's a 7-mile stretch called the Deep Cut. They blasted down into solid rock and up. They had to maintain the slope of the bottom of the canal because at this point the canal's drawing water out of Lake Erie. So you had to tilt it from Lake Erie to Lockport. And that's a drawing of it. You can see the towpath on the right that was high above the water. And this is a picture of it, a more contemporary picture of it in the winter. So you can see it's quite steep and dramatic. After Lockport and after the Deep Cut, it joined Tonawanda Creek, and that's the only place where it actually uses an existing creek, and it follows the creek down to where it empties into the Niagara River, and then the canal paralleled the Niagara River. You see it comes down here and then goes along the river until you got to Buffalo. So that's the Erie Canal in its original version. You know, in the shock of the old, David Edgerton argues we need to think less about invention and more about continuing use and maintenance. And you find that this is really what's lacking in the literature about the Erie. Most of the literature about the canal, whether it's academic or trade or popular, is about the canal's opening in first decades. Ronald Shaw has 2 great books that look at the canal from the perspective of antebellum political economy, and Carol Sharif wrote The Artificial River, which explores cultural responses to the canal and its role in building northern identity. Gerald Koppel wrote a popular book, but it's very good, A Study of the Politics and Process of Construction. Noble Whitford's magisterial, The Canal System of New York, it's this thick and it's so heavy I have to read it at home because it's too heavy to carry around, covers it up through the early 20th century, but it was written in 1905. There's some scattered work on the 20th century canal, mostly by local historians and canal buffs in central New York. Every year, however, brings yet another deluge of histories about the building of the Erie Canal. You know, and I'm here to tell you, it's a great story. I love telling the story of the building of the Erie Canal, but it's been done. And it's been done over and over again. But I think the excitement about the building of the Erie Canal, first of all, is why people think it's obsolete, because it freezes the canal in 1825. It's like, look what we built! Wasn't that great? You know, and then nothing. So there certainly hasn't been a lot of work on the environmental history of the canal. David Stradling's book, The Nature of New York, talks about the canal some. Carol Sharif acknowledges environmental changes, but she doesn't really do much with them. There's a great study from 1976 by a hydrologist with the USGS, but it's very much a geologist's 1970s perspective and doesn't really develop a full environmental picture. And all of these books tend to focus on impact rather than what's actually been created. Thomas Hughes defined technology as the ways we organize the world for problem solving, and the Erie Canal solved a problem. It solved an energy problem, it solved a transportation problem, and it did it by reorganizing and rationalizing the waters of New York State. And they did this by building, in the second phase, 300 more miles of canals in nine lateral canals. Now, the Champlain Canal is actually the earliest and was constructed about the same time as the Erie Canal. It starts where the Mohawk enters the Hudson and goes up to Lake Champlain. Okay, an interesting, important, and historic water route. Okay. But they also built all these, this was a very important one, the Oswego, from downtown Syracuse up to Lake Ontario. So this is a really extensive infrastructure, and this is what's really caught my attention for the time being. It taps into watersheds all over the state to feed the Erie Canal. The second benefit was that they connected a lot of towns to the main canal, but the primary reason for building these things is as feeder canals to bring the water in. And there's some interesting connections. You'll see this canal, the Chemung Canal, go down to Pennsylvania and hook up with the coal fields down there. You can see that the Hudson and Delaware Canal. So you're seeing almost a regional system bringing water under some kind of, or attempting to bring water under some kind of organizational control. And these are not just little ditches. This is just a second map of the canals. It's an older map, but it gives this kind of spidery extension, feeling of network, more than the easier to read map. And this is the Genesee River Canal, and that's the Genesee River down there to the right. And this is the canal. I'm assuming, I haven't mapped this canal, but I'm assuming that someplace up here there's a dam or a reservoir that's then feeding water off into this canal. This is the Black River Canal that comes down along the west side of the Adirondacks from Carthage, follows the Black River down, and you can see this is the base of it, where it has these final step locks coming down, and then an aqueduct across the Mohawk River, from which eventually the boats would get onto the Erie Canal itself. So, as I said, these all organize the waters of the state into an envirotechnical system. And what I think this does is it creates a distinctive riparian environment, some kind of, and a new set of relationships between people, land, and water. With its geographical size, its administrative complexity, and state management, the Erie Canal system is what Sarah Pritchard defines as an envirotechnical regime. So, quote, the institutions, peoples, ideologies, technologies, and landscapes that together define, justify, build, and maintain a particular envirotechnical system. So this is my point of entry to this impossibly large topic. I don't want to write a magisterial history of the Erie Canal, even an envirotechnical magisterial history, and I certainly don't want to contribute one single more word on the subject of the building of the canal between 1817 and 1825. But I am interested in the canal in the years after the Civil War, when it's a mature, extensive, technological system organizing the waters of New York State. Now, because the conventional narrative says that the railroads did away with canals, I've been thinking about the similarities between them. Because canals actually are like railroads in some ways. Every inch of the canal counts, just the way every inch of a railroad counts. During the Civil War, General William Sherman said, "I am never easy with a railroad, which takes a whole army to guard, every foot of rail being essential to the whole." Mm-hmm. And canals were the same way. Every piece that didn't work, every infrastructure that collapsed or let water out, or collapsed and blocked traffic, any lock gate that stuck or broke, brought traffic to a halt. If it leaked a lot of water out, it would literally strand these 30-ton canal boats on the bottom of the canal. They're, every foot, every piece is essential to the whole. They're quite literally downstream implications to breakages on the Erie Canal, whether in halted traffic, monies for repairs, flooded farmers' fields, etc. And so in many ways, it is a watery railroad. Canals are also similar to railroads because they're not standalone technologies. Railroads could not function without complementary technologies. Different tasks require different tools, different energies, different engines, and different economies. And this is one of my points in Horses at Work, that horses and railroads were complementary. Railroads were efficient at large-scale distance hauling over the fixed route of rails, and horses were efficient at small-scale, short-distance, flexible route hauling. Horses were terrible and costly at what railroads did, but the same is true in reverse. Railroads were terrible and costly at trying to do what horses did. The railroads would not have developed if not in relation to horsepower, because first, they wouldn't have been built, and second of all, they couldn't have functioned. Likewise, canals existed in conjunction with animal power, also steam power, also roads, and later with railroads. And this is where we get to the did the railroads render the canal obsolete question. Because what you find is you actually have to start learning a lot about what 19th century railroads were really like as technological structures. Railroads quickly took over much of the passenger traffic from canal boats, but they didn't take over the freight traffic. Early railroads were a fragmented, loosely coupled network of small railroads, all in bitter competition with each other, and often with different gauges, separate stations, different rolling stock, and without direct connections between the rails. So through traffic was pretty non-existent until you get into the 1870s or 1880s. While this was inconvenient for passengers, it was really impossible for bulky goods that require loading and offloading and perhaps storage facilities. And the railroads hated transporting this stuff. Like, all through the Civil War, the railroads fight the Union government. It's like, you know, it's one of those things like, what? Fight the Union government about hauling bulky goods. Like, they don't want to haul the hay, right? The Union has hundreds of thousands of horses. And the railroads are like, yeah, we don't do hay. So the quartermaster's always like cutting special deals, you know, with the railroads, like, haul the hay. Why don't they like to haul the hay? It's bulky. They don't have the equipment for easily loading it. So it takes a lot of manpower to load. It takes a lot of manpower to offload. And if you're transferring it from train to train, you have to store it and protect it. So a lot of work and a low profit margin, railroads weren't interested. And so, you know, they don't build the storage facilities that they need to accommodate through freight until the second half of the 19th century. So the Erie Canal carries, if you look at the records, they just carry a lot of big, heavy stuff, you know. Grain remains their biggest item, but they carry lumber, they carry rock, they carry coal. If it's big, heavy, and ugly, right, mm-hmm. The canal is doing it. However, in addition to these, the canal carries a lot of manufactured goods, because along the route of the canal through central New York, you know, all this industry springs up. And the canal was the preferred way to transport certain products. The thriving China industry was not interested in shipping their stuff by railroad. The beer industry was equally uninterested in shipping their stuff by railroad. So beer in China continue to travel because it's smooth and continuous transport. And so they retain a lot of freight until the end of the century. The peak decade of commerce on the Erie Canal is the 1870s. So it just goes up and up and up until then. And even today, the Erie Canal supplies what we might call a niche transport market. One of the items currently shipped on the canal barge are enormous wind turbine blades that are manufactured along the Mohawk River, and they come down the Erie Canal to the Hudson. They're heading in that direction. People who are canal watchers in central New York, the guy who is the head of the Erie Canal Museum in Syracuse, is third generation canal family. I'm discovering all these canal families. And he says, when gas prices go up, he said, the amount of commercial traffic on the Erie increases because it becomes more cost-effective to use the canal, and recreational traffic plummets. He says, I can always tell when gas prices are going down because recreational traffic soars and commercial traffic plummets. So it still has this niche transport function. Now, clearly, the canal is also different than railroads because it was built between known points of commerce, whereas the railroads, and especially if you look at Richard White's latest big fat book called Railroaded, brings home the knowledge that railroads were built on spec. Railroads were built to places that didn't exist in the hope that they would create traffic. But the canals are built between places that do exist, and between points of commerce. And I think this is what the lateral canals also reveal. They connect water, but they're also bringing the people and towns into the state management system. That if you're a canal town, you're dealing with the state and with this overall system. The canal is also different from railroads and roads in terms of maintenance. All of them are infrastructures that are subject to weather and wear, and they all need protection from the elements. But the canal as a water system is tied into the weather system much more directly. Rainfall, drought, snow, ice, and floods all affected the substance of the canal, which was the flow of water. If you look at even at the dates of the canal being opened, it varies from year to year because they couldn't open until it was safe in the spring from any more freezing, and they had to close in the winter, and that was always dicey if they could get the canal closed without trapping too many boats in the canal when they drained it in the winter. And there are stories of people saying, you read letters of people having to live on their canal boats all winter because it is resting on the bottom of the canal, and they didn't get out or get any place before the canal had to close. It ran roughly April to December, with ranging from about 210 days to some years, I think the highest number of days was about 250 days that it was open. Now, the goal of canal managers is to protect the canal from these natural forces of water, but at the same time, they're trying to manage water to their purposes within. So it's this funny system of kind of, we want to keep this water in and that water out. And in the meantime, they have all this infrastructure which is incredibly subject to the stresses of weather. Paul Edwards writes, to construct infrastructure is simultaneously to construct a particular kind of nature. So I read that and I thought, thank you, Paul. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to do here, to understand this particular kind of nature. The annual reports of the state engineer and surveyor for New York in the postbellum decades begin to provide a picture of this nature and reveal the envirotechnical regime through operations, personnel, technical problems, maintenance issues, and environmental concerns. And these reports remind us that hydrology was an integral part of civil engineering knowledge in the 19th century. So I'm now trying to master the history of hydrology and even the American politics of hydrology, which also involved the Army Corps of Engineers versus everybody else in terms of what knowledge was considered to be standard knowledge. In these engineer reports, the central issue always is water. The canals leaked constantly through the bottom and the sides, and so it wasn't just protecting the canals, keeping enough water coming in because you could not seal the canal so that water did not leak out. According to Walter Langevin, the total quantities of water taken into the canal made it the largest hydraulic undertaking of the century in the United States. Engineering reports cite attempts to measure stream flow and predict the availability of water from various sources, especially during summers and droughts. Starting in the 1830s, they built reservoirs to provide water, especially for the summit level of the Chenango Canal between Binghamton and Utica. That's the Chenango Canal. Now you drive up Route 12 toward Utica out of Binghamton, and you follow the Chenango River, and you ask yourself, what were they thinking? Of all the canals that were built, this maybe was the stupidest one to consider, and probably is testimony to the power of local politics. As a feeder canal, it probably wasn't a bad idea. As a canal for traffic on it, it was pretty problematic. The summit level of the canal, and the summit level is the highest point on a canal, and so that's where you would build reservoirs to feed that summit level, because in low water periods, especially in the middle of the summer, the summit levels went dry the quickest. So the Black River Canal, again, it's this one, fed into the canal at Rome, and they kept bringing additional capacity online, trying to tap into more of those waters. So a growing number of reservoirs are established as buffers against changing water levels, against drought. By the 1890s, there are more than 23 reservoirs and feeders, and the engineers write very proudly that they can provide 55 days of protection in case of drought and keep boats afloat in the canal. But even these measures could not guarantee water supplies and could not fully solve the hydraulic problem of getting an adequate volume of water flowing through the canal. Flow was affected by so many factors. It was affected by the amount of traffic in the canal. Like the more boats, it literally kind of bottles the water up at one end or the other. The slope of the canal bottom, sediment or vegetation, the frequency and timing of barges, of boats going through the locks, because every time you open the lock gates, there's a wave of water that comes out. And the lock keepers had to learn how to manage that so as not to strand boats upstream or not create a problem for the next lock. So there's a timing issue. It gets pretty technical. Any other issues of hydraulic drag, which all affected water levels? There are places on the canal that actually have a fairly big current, and you find them writing about their concerns that along here, there actually is a current in the Erie Canal that flows this way. So there was essentially an upriver canal and a downriver canal. But in this area, they have frequent concerns that the current's getting too fast. And that if the faster current is pouring drag on the horses, it slows down freight traffic. So they're constantly attempting to wrestle with hydrological knowledge about flow. In addition to the weather, there's also the problem that in many of the towns, people are diverting water from the canal to power mills. And the canal the canal commission actually sells water power in some places to mill owners, but the engineers complain about the amount of water that's being drawn out of the canal in places. So again, these begin to reveal some local politics, powerful mill owners against these little state engineers who are kind of in the middle of all of this. I picture them like jugglers, you know, water, politics, money, weather, and powerful interests that want something from the canal but don't necessarily understand the larger system. So these infrastructure failures contribute to, this an understanding of this nature of the canal. This is a canal breach. You see water starts piling out, and they would try to work quickly to seal the locks or to put and they had various places where they could try to seal sections of canals so that a canal breach didn't start draining more and more miles. flood damage occurs from culverts that carry cross streams under the canal and maybe start eroding the canal from the bottom. The natural sedimentation process of streams clogs those culverts and causes washouts that shut sections of the canal down for days or even weeks. Poor understanding of stream dynamics, and it led to some beautiful stonework on the canal. Stunningly beautiful culverts. They're very elegant, but they proved not to be so good for managing stream dynamics. Muskrats are a problem. They burrow into the canal banks and perforate them. Muskrats really like the canal banks, you know, but they dig in, and of course, what does that do? But it makes the, you know, makes it porous, and the next thing you know, the berm has given way, or else the towpath has collapsed. And if draining water out of the canal was a problem, a collapsed towpath was just as effective at stopping things, because that's the power line, right? So it's like you unplug all the power immediately. Sediment builds up in the canal bottom. Aquatic vegetation takes root. I mean, you know, again, the plants don't know it's a canal and not a river. It's like water, mud, you know, sewage, you know, food. So. Topics familiar to environmental historians appear in these reports. There was popular belief that Adirondack deforestation was causing low water levels in the Erie Canal, and that contributed to support for Adirondack preservation, as economic interests in the state said we have to protect the canal, and if that means we need to protect the forests in the Adirondacks. Though the scientific validity of this connection is still somewhat unclear, it demonstrates to me that they have an emerging understanding of environmental interconnections, that they're beginning to understand that there may be a connection between watersheds and logging in the Adirondacks. There are also concerns about water pollution in the canal and its possible impact on public health. Observations of the movement of fish species between bodies of water through the canal are forerunners of later concerns about canals as vectors for invasive species, such as zebra mussels, sea lampreys, or alewives. And there's still a level of uncertainty in the current literature about the role of the Erie Canal in the role of the lampreys and sea and zebra mussels in the Great Lakes. From the early days of the canal, smooth traveling on these canal boats, these gliding boats, very different than stagecoaches, very different than any other kind of transportation at the time, offered a chance for people to contemplate landscape in a new way. Stagecoaches were so difficult to travel in that people always hoped for a packed stagecoach so they wouldn't get thrown around the inside. And one traveler wrote that there were only two of them in a stagecoach, and that by the time they arrived at their destination, they'd been thrown around, he says, like potatoes in a bucket, and they were bruised all over. Southern ladies used to take laudanum before stagecoach journeys. They'd just zone out for the entire experience. So the smooth travel, you know, is not a new physical experience, and it's a new aesthetic experience. Passing through these wild and pastoral landscapes and contribute to this new nature aesthetic that we know develops from the antebellum period on. In the later part of the 19th century, the reports begin to comment on recreational boating. And there are things like canoe guides for the Erie Canal. And there's some powered launches. Some of the steam that is on the canal is often like a little pleasure launch, although they also run aground and run into difficulties with travel. So the Erie and its lateral canals create this riparian environment of land and water, narrow strips that penetrate almost every region of the state and into surrounding lakes and the watersheds of the Susquehanna and Delaware rivers. It stimulates development that alters the biota of the region, but I think it develops some kind of biota of its own. Muskrats, fish, and other wildlife, plant life in the water and on the banks. The Erie environment is interesting. It's urban in character. It's densely inhabited strip across New York State, densely inhabited by populations of humans and work animals. It's characterized by commerce and mobility. Then the lateral canals is much more pastoral. It's not so much development along those. Overall, this large statewide evolving landscape of complementary technologies and energies and new environments. This is one of my all-time favorite slides because it shows the trolley and the mules together and illustrates complementary technologies, right? The Erie Canal is a border zone. Right? It connects ecological, political, economic, technological, and social worlds in this kind of fluid dynamic along the way. So I think the story of the Erie Canal inverts how we usually see the world by revealing the meaning in small things, like the way that the shipping of China and beer tell us something about the envirotechnical regime of the Erie. And it makes me think about how nature is technological and about how technology gets naturalized. I think one reason the Erie Canal doesn't get taken seriously and is so easy to dismiss as obsolete is this smallness of it. It creates a very homey landscape. It's not the Hoover Dam. Yeah. It's not this one big thing in place. It's enormous, but it's all over the place, and it's in all these little pieces. At 40 feet wide, the width of the original canal, it's only as wide as the street I live on. Okay, this is Lincoln Drive in Mount Airy. Now, 40 feet is about from curb to curb there. So I went out and paced this one day at a low traffic time. So this is about 40 feet. Okay. Here, where I dropped this leaf, is about 70 feet. So when they expand the Erie to 70 feet, they expand it from here to here, right? Which is still, it's not so far. So it's an intimate structure, and it quickly gets naturalized into the landscape. This is a valley of the Black River Canal. You can see the canal right there. But it's this beautiful pastoral scene. There's not a whole lot of opposition between the canal and what's around it. It very quickly becomes this kind of second nature. And so I think this scale is very much part of the nature of the Erie. It creates a pastoral landscape which has, as we know, a very distinctive place in American culture. Now, add the horses and the mules, and you might as well hang a banner on it that says obsolete, right? The image of a horse or mule is like shorthand for, oh, this is an old, tiny thing, right? Even though we all know it's cutting edge. But I think the scale provides an opportunity, also for me, to reflect on some of the abstractions of modernity. I mean, the operation of the Erie, kind of in opposition to this kind of peaceful, rural, small-scale, pastoral scene, the operation of the Erie that comes out of these reports is an attempt at kind of high modernism, a la James Scott. I mean, they are very serious about, you know, what they're doing, and this is, you know, big politics, big structures, big attempts at management. But it's somehow this modernism gets pulled into something else. And when I look at the way that the Erie Canal's history has kind of been dismissed and even hidden, it makes me wonder if one of the characteristics of modernism, that ism or that itty that we're always struggling to describe and understand, I'm wondering if one of its maybe its characteristics isn't a contempt for the small and a contempt for work. So it's my hope that by studying things like horses and canals, we can complicate and criticize the technological and environmental stories that we tell about the 19th century. I especially would like to see much more of an assault on the steam and railroad hegemony that's been so dominant. I think that the deterministic power that historians have granted to railroads goes a long way toward explaining the power of the idea of obsolescence. I think obsolescence is joined at the hip with technological determinism. And despite the fact that we argue against determinism as historians, I assume everybody here argues against determinism when it's there to be argued against, I'm not so sure that we aren't part of what grants it power. When historians who don't study technological history don't understand how a technology works, they tend to borrow technological determinism and they wield it like a blunt instrument, right? Which is what accounts for all those books that say, oh, the railroads eliminated the horses. But as historians of technology, I think we sometimes unwittingly play into technological determinism. When we focus on larger, long-lasting, or more powerful technologies, I mean, for good reasons, because we're trying to understand them. You know, we're trying to unpack them, and we've got all these analytical tools that we can apply to them. But it ends up playing into the power of technological determinism because we, too, are not looking at, then, the alternatives. We're having a great time understanding automobiles or understanding the internet or, you know, name a technological or electricity. But I think it ends up then marginalizing, deprecating, or patronizing the alternatives maybe because of our silence as much as anything. Technological determinism is a will to power. It rises to power by trying to kill off its competitors, or worse, tags them as obsolete. It's almost like the technological version of bad social Darwinism. So, in conclusion, this project rests finally on two principles that guide my work. The first is what I think of as the Mohan-Lehrman principle, because the introductory essay that Arwin and Nina wrote for Gender and Technology states this principle so eloquently and clearly that I kind of understood it before, but then I read this essay and I thought, now I really get it. So you should all read this essay because it's really good, but also because she's department chair. Okay. So they simply state the material matters. The material matters. And it's one thing I talk to my students about over and over and over again. I said, start from the ground up. Understand it from the ground up. What is it? You know, how big is it? You know, right now I'm teaching a course on animal history, so I'm driving all my students crazy. Like, because I make them look at natural history. And they say, well, I'm interested in the bird, this bird. And I go, great, how big is it? From the ground up, understand it. What does it eat? Where does it live? What do you know about it? So we have to go below, beneath the surface meaning of things and understand the world literally from the ground up, understanding the material. My second principle is from Gabrielle Heck's work, because she said, we have to restore to the people of the past the choices of the past. And that, you know, like staying with the material, it's really important, it's really hard to do, you know, because we always have to keep remembering that, you know, they are us, you know. We have hindsight, but when it comes to the future, we're just, you know, we're just dancing in the dark, right? We're just blundering along. And they made choices, which it's easy to look back and say, well, that was stupid. I mean, I said it today. Why did they build the Janago Canal? You know, but, I'm hoping to understand that better, why that made sense to them. It doesn't make sense to me, but it made sense to them, and my opinion on that doesn't matter. What matters is their opinion. So I'm hoping that by looking at these waters of the Erie system and the people trying to manage them, that I can understand how the material mattered and what choices those people made. So that is what I've got for today. Now,